And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out, I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Gonna put one foot in front of the other
foot. I'm gonna sing out,
gonna march on. Got to keep on going.
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
When my grandmama marched.
Hi there. I'm Jeff Browning, and welcome to Benders of the Arc podcast, where we interview movers and shakers for social change. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. famously said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice. But does it bend by itself, like a naturally occurring rainbow coming to Earth? Or does it bend when people and social movements grab hold of that arc and bend it toward justice? We will explore this and many other questions in this series, and we invite you to join us on this adventure and exploration of social change. In 2018, the Presbytery of San Jose voted to become a sanctuary presbytery. They did this because of the ongoing threat to immigrant families being separated and because they believe the aggressive actions by this administration violates the gospel call of welcome and refuge. Since then, the presbytery, led by the Peace and Justice Task Force, has been helping churches to discern their call to become sanctuary churches. One way they are living into that challenge is to begin accompanying immigrants in their effort to become permanent residents. Our guests today are Holly Brady from First Presbyterian Church of Palo Alto. Holly serves on the accompaniment team of that church. Nicholas Hurley is a member of Stone Church of Willow Glen in San Jose and also serves on their accompaniment team. Holly and Nicholas, welcome to Benders of the Ark. Let's begin by discussing what the difference is between accompaniment and sanctuary, if you could.
Well, sanctuary is an older idea, and in the 80s, our church was a sanctuary church, and it oftentimes meant for people of that period that someone would come and live in your church. And you would deal with meals and showers and so on and so forth. That is not what accompaniment is. Accompaniment is different. It's more taking a family under your wing. The family generally lives on its own, and trying to help them navigate all of the legal and emotional and medical issues that happen to them as they apply for asylum or some kind of green card.
And additionally, and on top of all that, you know, we can also do the same thing for families who have been here for many years and have had a family member who has been detained by ICE. So, you know, someone gets picked up for whatever reason, usually not a good one, and then the family is left behind, and the family members left behind are usually not the ones with the job, and so they need assistance making their way through the world while also trying to figure out, again, all the legal and emotional things that go along with having a loved one with the possibility of being deported.
Mm-hmm. So I guess I'm just wondering why and how did you get into the business of accompaniment?
For us, it's been kind of a long journey at Stone. Back in the 80s, well before I was at Stone, we apparently voted to be a sanctuary support church back in that old sanctuary movement.
And then more recently, in it was either 2015 or 2016, I'm not sure which, we voted to reaffirm our commitment to being a sanctuary support church. It had actually been so long ago that we just voted to be a sanctuary support church again, not realizing that we had already done it, you know, 30 years prior. Mm-hmm. And for a time, that was kind of it. Some of us went to the Disgrace Conference in Montreat in 2016, came back with a whole host of ideas around addressing racism in the church. And as part of that, we invited a woman from Sacred Heart. Her name is Rosa. She's a DACA recipient, and she worked at the time at Sacred Heart, you know, with the undocumented community. And this was, you know, shortly after the presidential election, and Sacred Heart, along with PAC, was in the process of setting up the Rapid Response Network of Santa Clara County to, you know, help provide legal services for people who had been picked up by ICE. And
so if you could just tell us a little bit what the Rapid Response Network actually is.
Yeah, so it's a phone number. There's a phone number that people can call anytime they see or think they see ICE in their neighborhood. They don't even have to be actually doing anything. If you, you know, you think you saw a person walking around in an ICE vest, you can call. And what happens when you call the number is rapid responders, of which I am one, will show up based on, you know, how close it is to where they are, and just kind of document the situation. There's no interfering with ICE. There's no, you know, we don't want more people to get arrested or anything. But we document the situation because in a large number of cases, ICE does not follow the law when they're arresting people. And so we document that, and that provides, you know, kind of ammunition for the lawyers to try to get someone out of detention if they've been picked up by ICE. So the network also helps provide lawyers. They have lawyers who have agreed to work for very low or pro bono. And, you know, we also work with networks around the country where if, you know, someone, you know, one network is low on resources, but they've had an uptick in activity, you know, we can kind of help send out a call for donations for that local network. And there's a bunch of these networks around the country. Mm-hmm. So Rosa came to Stone and talked about the Rapid Response Network. And I went to actually one of the first trainings to become a rapid responder around here. And kind of based on where I live, there's not a whole lot of ICE activity going on in that area. Not a whole lot of people they care to mess with around there. But, you know, as time has gone on and things have gotten messier and messier, the network also started setting up what we call accompaniment teams, which is, you know, a group of people. It's almost always based in a faith community of some sort. And, you know, when someone is picked up, because for all our efforts, we can't stop it all, right? When someone is picked up, their family can, you know, say, hey, I need help navigating this. You know, my husband or my partner or my son or daughter or wife has been abducted by the government, and I don't know what to do now. And so as things got worse, I went back to Stone with another congregant there, Rhonda Lakatos, and, you know, we decided we needed to get this set up at Stone. There was no accompaniment team for the network anywhere in our general vicinity. They were all either further north or further south in the county from us. Mm-hmm. So we started an accompaniment team at Stone, and, you know, had Jesus from PACT come and show us the ropes, give us a little training on it, and recruited some people, and now we're been accompanying our first family for almost 6 months now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's great. Holly, how did you get involved with, and First Press get involved with the accompaniment program?
Well, First Press is also a sanctuary church and had people living in its library for in the 1980s. And so we had deep roots in this area. And we've always been monitoring this situation. In 2015, a number of us went to the border with border links to educate ourselves about what was going on in the border. We came back, and among other things, we developed a relationship with the Day Workers Center of Mountain View and tried to provide ongoing support for them. And then in 2019, we went again, and you were there, Jeff, with us. We went together, and a lot had changed. A lot had gotten worse, I think. And when we came back from that trip, we were all charged to do something. And what we learned on that trip was that the people who were at the border and are doing this every day seem to think that accompaniment is a better way than sanctuary. They labeled sanctuary as a sort of a last resort failure of what we can do. Accompaniment was much more important. So we wanted to do that when we came back from the border. We were all fired up to do it. A number of us got trained in rapid response training. I was one of them. I think you were one of them. We did ours over at Stanford, and I've gone out on a couple of calls. They're very nerve-wracking, but I think they're really important. But then we decided that we were ready for accompaniment, and on our way back, we were asked by the executive director of the Day Workers Center to accompany a particular person that she knew from her work with day workers.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got there.
Great, great. And I seem to recall that, Allison Harrington was one of the people that we met with.
That's right.
Down in Tucson when we were visiting there. And I think she's the one who pointed out, and I thought it was just so very powerful way that she pointed out that accompaniment is the way to go, and that in some respects sanctuary is almost a failure. A failure of I can't quite recall how she said it, but
I think it was, who wants to live in a church?
Right. You lose all of your connections.
Yeah.
And so that if we can...
And your liberty.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that if we can accompany them sort of along the way so that they can avoid sanctuary, needing sanctuary, that's actually a preferred outcome for them and for everybody. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess, what would you like the churches to know about accompaniment, and from your experiences?
I think accompaniment is challenging for a church. There are issues that come up. You have to have flexibility and roll with the punches, whatever happens. In our experience, the first few weeks were the hardest, because our family, which consisted of a Guatemalan father and his son, had very few resources and were living in an RV that I'm not sure had, I don't know whether it had electricity, and I don't know whether it even had water. And it also did not have an address. And the two big things that were happening when we met our family was, the father had been notified by the court that he needed to go to court within the next week, and the son had some difficult dental problems, and so he was in a lot of pain. So that's what we started with. It was a scramble to address some of those things. We also found out that there was some bullying at school of the son. The son was in school, but not doing particularly well. And so we had to address that as well. So we had to scramble at the very beginning. Then things calmed down a little bit, and we started in on the process of finding a pro bono attorney and applying for asylum with the government.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would just kind of echo most of what Holly said. It's, you know, it's a lot of work. It's very fulfilling work. You know, to see the difference that, you know, for someone like me, or I'm guessing any of us sitting here, living in a very privileged position in a very privileged part of the country, you know, to see that, you know, there are people living with so much less than we have, and then when even that gets taken away from them, how the smallest things from our point of view can make such a big difference for them, you know, literally can keep them from losing their home or being kicked out of the country or anything like that. But yeah, it is very much a kind of thing where you have to just be willing and ready to roll with the punches, because unexpected stuff comes up all the time, and you have to be able to run with it, because in these moments, you are the rock for the family that you're accompanying, and they need to have the space to grieve or handle whatever is going on, and you just need to be that steady presence for them.
We've had some help from a different group than what Nicholas and his group have worked with. We have been relying on the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity to guide us in what we should be doing and how we navigate some of these problems. They are just like PACT and Sacred Heart, because I know a little bit about them as well, but they're all of them are very good resources for people.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it takes a village to do this.
It does.
Right. Yeah. Let's take a break, and when we come back, our guests will tell us what they have learned from their families about seeing the world through the eyes of immigrants.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on. And everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
If you are new to the Benders of the Ark podcast, please visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com, where you can find more information about our stories and the people behind them. Now let's return to our guests.
I'm really struck by how, when I see our systems through our family's eyes, I realize how difficult they are. Our legal system, our medical system, our transportation system. I mean, I can't imagine them trying to do this without having somebody to at least come up alongside them and help them figure out what the heck they need to do next.
Yeah, these are things that are, you know, minor frustrations for us most of the time, right? Oh, I got a ticket. Okay, well, but for an undocumented person, you know, getting a parking ticket is a terrifying thought.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit about what do these families actually need? You've pointed out a few things, Holly, but and Nicholas, but what other sorts of things are you discovering that they really need?
So in our case, in large part, for the moment, it's been income. The husband was the sole source of income in the family. The wife and the daughter, who's you know, middle school aged, the wife had not been working. She was a stay-at-home mom, and she is also undocumented, so getting a job is very difficult for her. And so they, you know, they were pretty okay in terms of being able to do their daily life. You know, she has a driver's license, she can take the daughter to school and all this stuff, but they just, you know, needed to be able to stay in their apartment. Needed to be able to buy food to eat, to put gas in the car so they could get to school. And so, you know, bare minimum, it's that. And also paying the exorbitant costs to talk to the husband. Attention. It is, I may be switching the numbers around, but I believe it's $20 for 12 minutes to talk on the phone to someone in a detention center.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
it's
and he's in detention where?
He originally was in Yuba City, which is about as close as it gets for detention centers mm-hmm. to the Bay Area. And then a few months ago, he was moved down to San Diego.
Hmm. So going and visiting him is not really an option.
No. No, and doubly so. The daughter was born here, and she's an American citizen. But, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. for the wife, who is undocumented herself, understandably, she doesn't want to go anywhere near that mm-hmm. detention
mm-hmm.
center.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Right.
Our situation was a little bit different in that we had a working father and his young son. He immediately, well, the first thing that happened was when they came up, they had the clothes on their back, and they had, to my knowledge, no food. He actually asked for money for water at one point in time. So I don't know whether, that's why I wonder whether he had water in the RV that he was living in. So food, water, and housing were the first things that needed to be addressed. And we took him to Goodwill for some of the clothing that he needed. The housing he found on his own, which was good. And for food, it was interesting. We took him to Walmart, and he bought things that I never would have expected. And I think that came from just where he came from in Guatemala. He was buying very large pieces of meat. Hmm. And I was just hoping that he had refrigeration.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just didn't know. Then medical and dental were very fast on the heels of that. Help with school. And then what happened was he had gotten one job very quickly, and he got a second job relatively quickly. And the second job required that he have gray pants and black shoes. So one morning at 7 a.m., we got a call that he needed gray pants and black shoes in order to get to work at 9. Mm. So one of our team had to go with him, take him to Walmart to get mm-hmm. a pair of those things, which he did. After that, there are legal services that they need, and that's a whole other conversation. Court dates, fingerprinting. They oftentimes say, "If this is our father is applying for asylum, so he needed to have his fingerprinting done. He needed to go to court several times. We had to help him fill out the asylum papers. We had to find a pro bono attorney who would help us do that."
Mm-hmm.
And all of that took a lot of transportation. You know, down into San Jose, up into San Francisco court. So there was a lot of transportation needs that mm-hmm. we had to fulfill some mm-hmm. one or the other.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's certainly a lot going on. So how do you do this? I mean, it sounds like you need a whole team of people. So how many people are helping you to actually do this?
We have probably somewhere between 4 and 6 people that are generally regularly involved. There's myself and Rhonda who kind of lead up the efforts. We've done a lot of the fundraising, both through GoFundMe and other sources. Rhonda and we'll periodically go and visit with the wife, and you know, of course, we deliver money and anything else she may need at that time, but also just to sit and talk with her because you know. She doesn't have a whole lot of people to talk to mm-hmm. these days. We have a woman who has been helping tutor the daughter in math and reading. Mm-hmm. The daughter was already struggling in school, and then, you know, when one of your parents gets jailed, it makes things that much harder to focus.
Right.
We do have, even though the mother speaks much better English than we were originally led to believe, we do have a Spanish speaker to handle other communications with her. You know, she's still very much more comfortable in Spanish. And then, you know, we have a whole village of people who have donated money for this to cover, you know, the daily living expenses and other unexpected things. The husband's business license was up for renewal.
Hmm.
So we paid that, so that didn't become a larger problem. Paying for the car to get out of impound, paying for, you know, registration renewals for the cars so that that didn't become another point of contact with the authorities. And we have had probably about 20 people in total donating monetarily, and plenty of other people also just helping brainstorm, you know, how can we help her get more on her own two feet so that she doesn't have to feel like she has to rely on us, like we're her only hope, because we're not. But yeah, sometimes it's hard to see.
We have 5 to 6 people on our accompaniment team, and in fact the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity told us that that was about the right number. Originally we had about 20 people who were interested, and when Interfaith Movement wanted to come down and train us, they said, no, we're not going to train 20 people, we want to train the 5 people who are going to be doing it. So that's what we did. And interestingly enough, we have one person who knows Spanish, and that's very helpful, because our Guatemalan father and his son, neither of them know any English. Now the son, now that he's been here a few months, I think he's doing much better than the father. But so we needed someone to do that. We happen to have an attorney on our team. He is not an immigration attorney, but he is an attorney, and he knows how to navigate courts. And he called the court to figure out the court date, and he took our father up one time and sort of assessed the situation and assessed the judge, and knew how to do that, knew how to sort of navigate those kinds of things. We also have a nurse, retired nurse on our team, and she's been very helpful in terms of the medical issues. So it's nice to have, it's nice to call on people who have those kinds of skills. So we have a nice group, although it's quite small.
Yeah. And I should also mention, because the husband in our family is currently in San Diego, we have actually reached out and gotten help from the Presbytery of San Diego as well. For his last court date, the executive presbyter who down there, whose name I am forgetting right now, actually went to the court just to be a presence there for him, and brought letters from his family and from our congregation and pictures of his family as well, because he had not seen his family in 5-6 months.
Wow. How long has he been in detention?
It's been just about 6 months now.
Wow.
And I should also mention, in terms of money, because you had talked about your GoFundMe, we haven't done that, but what we do have an active social justice committee at First Pres Palo Alto with a budget, and some of that budget has been reallocated for accompaniment and has gone to the needs of the family. When the dental issue came up for the son, we just passed the hat in church, and we got enough money for what turned out to be 2 pediatric root canals.
It occurs to me that one of the things we haven't really discussed yet is what's kind of the theology that underpins this, the biblical and theological perspective. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts about that. Did you do any exploration of that or conversations about that in your respective communities?
We did. Actually, when Jesus from PACT came and did the training, and I wish I had the handout here with me, because I can't remember the passages he picked out, but he had 2 or 3 passages from the Old Testament, 2 or 3 of the multitude of passages about, treating the stranger in your midst with kindness and not oppressing them, and, taking care of the widow and the orphan and all these things. That was definitely, like I said, even part of the training that PACT did for us. And of course they pick from the Old Testament, because there are also Jewish congregations that are doing this work as well. And you can also see it throughout the Bible. There's the arc of you know, I am the Lord your God who led you out of bondage in the land of Egypt, right? I don't know how many times God introduces God's self that way, but it's a pretty common theme. And so once you pick up on that, it's kind of hard not to think that this is something that we should be doing, you know?
We have two pastors, both of whom are very social justice oriented, Bruce Reyes Chow and Ananda Barclay, and they talk about this a lot in the pulpit. And we also invited Deborah Lee, who is the executive director of the Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity, to come and preach. She did an excellent job of underpinning what we were doing with theology. And we've invited her actually to the presbytery, next presbytery meeting, to do that, the same talk. I think that what they all have done is pointed in the direction of the fact that we all have white privilege, and this is a way we can use our white privilege. And it's something that I've just been learning over the course of the last few years, how easy it is for me to navigate the systems here. No one questions me when I show up. And that's something that is valuable that I can use for helping these kinds of folks. And if I have it, I want to use it.
And I know that in some cases, you know, some of us have been able to go to San Francisco when they have a court date or something. And sometimes I know the people and sometimes I don't. But somehow just showing up seems to be important. And sometimes it's a very powerful experience. I remember in one of the court cases, the courtroom was filled with, I don't know, 30 or 40 people. And the judge actually turned the camera that he was, it was a remote video situation, and turned the camera so that the immigrant could see all the people in the courtroom, and he was just blown away by all the people that were there to support him, and it certainly made an impact on the judge. Well, so I guess one of the other questions that occurs to me is, what are the most surprising things to you about accompaniment that you've learned or found during your accompaniment?
I think for us, they've largely been related to that white privilege, you know, knowing how to navigate things in our society, and recognizing, you know, it's one thing to be like, oh yes, I recognize that I have white privilege and life is easier for me because of it. And it's another thing entirely to see it in action, right? To see a person who, like I said, whose car has been impounded, and because they're undocumented, you know, well, first of all, they always kept the registration and everything in the car, so they didn't have that to hand over to the police to get the car out. And because they were originally married in Honduras, where they're from, they didn't have a marriage license that the police were going to accept to say, no, really, this is my husband's car. Can you give this to me, please? And just all through these things. And even then, after that, it was... once they were able to get the car out of impound, with Rhonda using her white privilege to navigate all these things and, you know, talk to people, another member at Stone who works for the city, who could then talk to one of the assistant chiefs of police who, you know, was in charge of impound and all that stuff, to kind of grease the skids and help things along there. Driving back, she doesn't want to drive on the highway because... you're more likely to have an interaction with the highway patrol if you do that, which is another thing that she wants to avoid. So just, yeah, all these little things that I take for granted, that, you know, I'm going to be able to pay my mortgage or my rent next month, that I'm going to be able to buy food for my kids, that, you know, buying them school uniforms isn't a problem, that of course I can buy them that little toy that they want or take them out to a movie or to play mini golf. Mm-hmm. When, you know, there are people that are living on $2,000 a month, which sounds absurd mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. How do you even do that? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But there are people that do it, and there are a lot of people that do it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When last summer, when they were sort of at the height of separating families, a number of us went down to the San Diego border with PACT, actually, to protest. And our intent was actually to get arrested. And we were trained by PACT on what to do if we were arrested. We had numbers put on our forearms to call the bail bondsman when we were arrested.
Mm-hmm,
and those of us who were trained had wristbands so that they knew that, you know, we had been trained. And one of the things that we did, we were with about 1,000 people at that time, and about 30 of us had been trained and were ready to go in and do that. And as we were walking by the detention center at San Isidro, mm-hmm. I think it was,
yeah.
It was a desolate place, not anything around but this great big massive building that had very few windows. We were walking past and we were chanting, we were going toward the entrance where we were going to basically be civilly disobedient and go and trespass onto the property. We were walking by and we were chanting, we were all chanting, 1,000 people were chanting, and because we were chanting together, there was a pause in the chant. And we were basically chanting something like, I can't remember what we were doing, but we were chanting something like, you know, this is not right, you know, this people should not be separated from their children. And we stopped the chant, and we looked at the big building, and all of a sudden, from the big building came the sound of women's voices, and they said, in Spanish, we were told, they said, "We hear you, do you know where our children are?"
Mm.
That was a surprise.
Wow. That is very powerful. Because I think that's one of the things that I find so upsetting about the policies of this administration is a separation of children from their families. And of course it happens whether they're coming across a border or whether they're picked up and separated because they're put in detention, or any number of ways that this can happen. And it's so traumatic for the children. It's just unbelievable that we are allowing this to happen in our name. Let's take another break. And when we come back, we'll ask our guests about what accompaniment has taught them about themselves and the impact that it has had on their congregations.
And we'll say, I'm gonna sing out. I'm gonna march on, and everybody said,
I'm gonna sing out.
Gonna march on.
I'm gonna march on.
Be sure to visit our blog at bendersoftheark.com. There you will find more information about becoming an accompaniment congregation and the organizations that can help you to become more involved. What have you learned about yourselves by accompanying these families? I think Nicholas, you said that part of it was learning about our own white privilege.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. There's also been, you know, I learned I have skills I didn't realize I had. I can fundraise. Mm-hmm. Who knew? Mm-hmm. and you know, as a church, we have learned that, you know, we really can come together and do the work of God in the world. You know, Stone has a long history of doing this, and when I joined Stone 7 years ago, I feel like Stone had maybe gotten into just a little bit of a comfortable place. You know, there was still plenty going on, right? Still, you know, June Tablack still going to Sacred Heart every week and making sandwiches, even in her 90s, all that
mm-hmm,
stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But there hadn't, it didn't seem like there had been a big thing where the congregation really came together. And, you know, since we called our new pastor, Reverend Sammy Evans, she started just over 2 years ago now, we've got two of these. We've been doing a compliment. We also now host a rotating women's shelter once a year. And so it's been a good way for Stone to be reminded of who we are and remember and find the joy in really living into that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, you look at your hands, you look at your mind, you think, okay, what can I do? And you realize that, yeah, I can, you know, I can show up.
Yeah.
I can show up. And I think that's really what I've learned through all of this.
Mm-hmm.
And that showing up is surprisingly more powerful than you think it would be.
Yes.
When you just think about it in the abstract.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, you think, oh, what? Okay, I showed up.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
it really makes difference in people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, in liberation theology context here, one of the things that has always been a powerful marker for me is in liberation theology, it's those that we serve who share the gospel with us,
mm-hmm.
that in a way they are evangelizing us, they are helping us to discover the gospel.
Yeah.
And I find that very powerful and meaningful. And it sounds like that's what you're involved in. That's what you're describing here in a very beautiful way.
For sure. I feel like my faith has deepened even more in these 6 months just through being there for our family,
mm-hmm.
standing with them and helping in whatever little way I can.
Mm-hmm. And how has this affected your congregations, do you think?
Well, I know for my congregation, there was a little trepidation at first. You know, you say we're going to help an undocumented immigrant, and sometimes people go immediately to, well, isn't that going to get us in trouble? Or, you know, aren't we going to be on the hook then? And, you know, it's an understandable fear, right? It's the stranger things have happened, for sure. And, but I think for the whole congregation, seeing how we are able to just be there for someone has really settled those fears, calmed those fears, and given us a new sense of purpose and meaning and care. You know, there isn't a coffee hour that goes by that I don't get asked, oh, how's our family doing? What's the latest update? You know, what's going on? Is there anything we can do to help today?
Mm-hmm.
Anything we can do to help this week? It's been truly life-giving, I think, for the entire congregation, even, you know, for those who haven't participated directly in it, just to know that we are here and standing with people is an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think working on social justice issues like this, feet on the ground, really brings an energy to a congregation, even if they can't themselves get out and do whatever needs to be done. Some people are supporting with money, some people are supporting with, you know, hands, some people are supporting with bringing clothing and so on and so forth. So with First Press Palo Alto, everybody is involved in some way or another, I think, mentally in what is going on. There are also other things that are going on at First Press Palo Alto. Like, we have a very active environmental justice group that has done some amazing things. And that's a very small group as well. We're spread very thin. And it sounds like there's a whole bunch of us doing a whole bunch of stuff. But really, it's five or six people over here and four or five people over there. And just those small teams can make a big difference. Because we're only about 150 people total.
Well, and I guess one of the questions that I have is, what kind of message would you like to send to other congregations? If you had a chance to speak to other congregations in the presbytery, what would you tell them about accompaniment?
Well, I know that Interfaith Movement for Human Integrity is trying to move its services down into the peninsula area, and they're looking for more churches. So clearly there is a need for this. And so I would hope that other churches would seriously consider this and get in touch with them and talk a little bit about it. They come down and do a sort of a workshop first and let people know what it's like. And then the churches can decide whether they want to take on a family or not, and they'll assign them a family that's local and in need. And I think it's well worthwhile, both for deepening faith and also for making a difference in the world now.
I would agree with Holly. There's PACT as well is always looking for more churches. There's always more and more families who are being affected by this, and even if you don't get a family immediately, you will be put in contact with the other congregations around doing the work, and they and we can always use help too. It takes a certain amount of money to do this for a lot of the families, and sometimes some months you can get it, some months it becomes a bit harder. And so the more we can spread that ask around, or the ask for one of our congregants actually helped a family who actually was in sanctuary over on the east side. But one of our congregants once a week drove the kids to school because their kids were going to school over in Campbell. And so, there's all kinds of things that you can do, even if you're not directly hosting an accompaniment team. You can still get involved in the work, and you should get involved in the work.
Well, thank you, Holly Brady from First Presbyterian Church of Palo Alto and Nicholas Hurley from Stone Church of Willow Glen. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's been very powerful and moving.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Benders of the Ark, exploring social justice and social change with those who are daring to do the hard work to bend the arc of the moral universe toward justice. Thank you also to the Presbytery of San Jose for daring to become a sanctuary presbytery and assisting in the production of the Benders of the Ark podcast. Thank you also to Colette and Doug Liner for their technical assistance. Our music is a splendid creation of Joshua Campbell titled Sing Out, March On. Next week, we will interview Maria Marroquin, the director of the Mountain View Day Worker Center. You won't want to miss her insights and perspective. Until then, keep bending the arc of the moral universe toward justice for all God's people.